From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. COVID-19 continues to spread around the globe. Health officials in Europe and the Middle East are scrambling today to limit new outbreaks of the coronavirus. Iraq, Afghanistan, Kuwait, and Bahrain have reported their first cases, and more than 800 people have been infected in South Korea, second only to China, where the outbreak started. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us now from Seoul. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Peter.
And so President Moon Jae-in over the weekend put the country on its highest alert as it tries to slow down the spread of this disease. What's the significance of that, and what powers does that give the government?
This hasn't happened since 2009, that they raised the alert to its highest level. And that allows the government to close schools, to limit transport links in and out of the country. It's been pretty psychologically shocking to people, I think, to see the numbers skyrocket so much. They were doubling every day for several days last week, and they, of course, surpassed Japan to become the number two country with the most cases outside of China. And disruptions to people's lives have been pretty serious. The national legislature shut down today because an infected visitor got into the legislature. Mm. Courts have been told to postpone their trials. Museums and libraries are closed. The start of a new school semester has been postponed. And the professional soccer league had to put off the start of its season. So a lot of people are panicking.
Some of the first cases were reported in this city of Daegu, and those cases appear to have started among members of a secretive church. What's the latest on how and why this appears to have taken off in South Korea?
The first infections came from China, but then transmission started to go local within the country. In Daegu, the streets are empty. Everyone's been told to stay home, and they're pretty much doing it. Everywhere else in South Korea, people are being told to self-quarantine if they show symptoms of a fever or respiratory illness. More than half of the cases in South Korea are with this religious group called the Shincheonji Church of Jesus, which has been around since the 1980s. And they are very aggressive proselytizers, and their critics say that that is how they spread the disease, in crowded church services, passing out flyers on the street. And also because they don't want to be identified, because people do not want to be proselytized, they often hide their affiliation. And so when people come into contact with them, they don't know to protect themselves or quarantine themselves. A lot of people would like to see this group disbanded. There's a petition on the presidential website calling for the government to just take them down, disband them.
So in China, of course, there are many more reported cases. Health workers there have had trouble keeping up with the infections. What's the healthcare system like in South Korea? Will it be able to cope with a larger outbreak?
Well, South Korea is known for having a pretty well-developed national health system. It's affordable for most folks. It's high-quality care, and they're starting to take on medical tourists from around the world. And they have a pretty good track record of tackling previous outbreaks such as SARS, MERS, bird flu, swine flu. And they're also very good at testing a lot of people pretty fast. They've tested about 28,000 suspected cases, and about 19,000 of those have come up negative. So they're still waiting for results. But this means that the results may look like the numbers grow pretty quickly. But then you compare that with other countries which say they have no cases, but it may be because they don't know they have them or can't test for them.
Were they more prepared because the country is so close to China?
Well, they have a lot of links with China, and that complicates it. They have a lot of ethnic Korean people from China who go back and forth. And that's you know, one reason that it spread there fairly quickly.
Any concerns that this outbreak could move on to North Korea, which would be far less prepared for an outbreak?
Yeah, there's a lot of concern about that. North Korea keeps on insisting that it doesn't have any cases. But people who know the system, including North Koreans who've defected to the South, say in past epidemics, North Korea has just covered up the cases or underreported them. This time they've closed their border with China, as they have in past, but it's never worked. They've never been able to keep epidemics from spreading. The country has chronic malnutrition, with 40% of the people not getting enough to eat. They lack a lot of basics like medical supplies and equipment, including also running water and sanitation. So they really are not well equipped to handle an epidemic. Aid groups in both the U.S. and South Korea say they're ready to send supplies and help North Korea, but North Korea has not requested anything officially, so there's not much they can do.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn speaking with us from Seoul. Anthony, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, let's turn now to the apparent Democratic frontrunner in the race for the White House. On CBS's 60 Minutes last night, Bernie Sanders played down concerns that his democratic socialism and calls for political revolution will mean trouble in this critical week. Voters first in South Carolina next week, and then on Super Tuesday. Here's Sanders with host Anderson Cooper.
A lot of voters are voting for candidates who aren't calling for Medicare for all, who aren't calling for a revolution. Is everybody really wanting a revolution like that?
Let's go easy on the word political revolution. You know, we're trying to follow.
You're the one who's used
the
word.
But I don't want people, to overstate them.
Well, maybe too late, because words like revolution and socialist are reportedly putting the Democratic Party in a panic that Bernie Sanders might be their candidate. Matt Bennett of the center-left group Third Way told Politico, in 30-plus years of politics, I've never seen this level of doom. I've never had a day with so many people texting, emailing, calling me with so much doom and gloom. And he said he's the most depressed he's ever been in politics. Adrian Elrod was director of strategic communications for the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign. Clinton, of course, beat Sanders for that nomination. So, Adrian, are you feeling panic?
Yeah, I'm not feeling the kind of panic I think that my dear friend Matt Bennett is feeling, because here's the thing. While I think that, yes, having somebody who is a self-described socialist, democratic socialist at the top of the ticket could very well hurt some of these down ballot races, especially some of those races that you'll recall that we won in 2016, historical wins up and down the ballot for Democrats. And a lot of those races were won and decided by suburban voters. So if he is able to keep the coalition that he had going for him in Nevada intact going into Super Tuesday, then we may not see these down ballot races hurt or damage as much. But that's still unknown, and we still have a long ways to go in this primary.
Well, Sanders also showed Nevada that he can win over moderates. Then national polls and polls in swing states show him beating Trump and coming close even in a conservative state like Texas. So, I'm sure his backers are saying, what are you worried about?
Yeah, and I think that that's still the unknown factor. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of digging into some of these crosstabs and polls to find that a lot of people, again, a lot of those moderate Democrats, a lot of swing voters, a lot of independents have real concerns with somebody who supports Medicare for all, somebody who, again, is a self-described socialist, a democratic socialist at the top of the ticket. But I think it also has a lot to do with who backs him. If he is the general election nominee for the Democratic Party, he will have the full force of the Democratic Party behind him. You will see heavyweight surrogates like President Obama, Secretary Clinton, President Clinton. You will have the party apparatus that unifies behind him, because there is so much stake at this election.
One thing I constantly remember is in 2016, when we went to Iowa, just, before that election, the first thing I heard from young men in particular was they were trying to decide between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, which, people thought was incredible. I called back and said, this is what I'm hearing. Is it possible also that Bernie Sanders might be able to get someone who's just looking for a disruptor, take away some of those Trump voters?
Yeah, and I think that that's what's so interesting about Bernie Sanders potentially being the Democratic nominees, because, can he go back into Michigan? Can he go back into Pennsylvania? Can he go back into Wisconsin and peel back some of those voters as working class voters, people who, are upset about the economy? They feel like Trump didn't help them like they thought he would. Can Bernie Sanders get those people back in his corner? That's the real question. It is unconventional, but I'm not quite in the doomsday scenario that Matt Bennett is, because I do think that he could end up building this group of people that's unique that can help propel candidates forward.
Real briefly, Adrian Elrod, just want you to, as briefly as you can, take a stab at two questions. What's your advice for the other candidates in tomorrow's debate? Do they, attack Bernie Sanders, or should everybody start pivoting and attacking Donald Trump? And what do you think Bernie Sanders has to do? Does he have to have more ads that come out with him looking right at the camera and explaining what a democratic socialist is or what he means by revolution?
Well, if I was anybody other than Bernie Sanders on that debate stage tomorrow night, I would take on Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the front runner. He is the person that everyone, if they want to stay in this race past Super Tuesday, needs to take on. So I would take him on. I think a lot of this depends on how he performs after Super Tuesday. And if he looks like he is getting close to having a insurmountable number of delegates that nobody else can take over, then yes, he probably needs to start pivoting to a general election strategy and looking in the camera and having real conversations with voters about what it means to be a Democratic Socialist. And, you know, he frankly needs to give people some assurances that we will still live in a capitalist society.
That's Democratic strategist Adrian Elrod. Adrian, thank you.
Thank you so much.
What's good, y'all? As you know, February is Black History Month. And all throughout that month, NPR's Code Switch is going to be running a special series about the history of Black resistance. Because as long as Black folks have been oppressed in this country, which is, you know, forever, we've also been fighting back. Listen and subscribe.
We are about to travel to a strange new world. Virtual reality can help doctors learn new techniques and maybe even teach astronauts to walk on Mars. But when it comes to gaming, some people say that VR hasn't lived up to its promise. So I'm about to go see for myself.
Well, I've been a gamer my entire life, but this allows you to be a character in a game instead of manipulating a character on screen.
That is Scott Matalon. He and Michael Klebnik head up a company called Metro VR. It's a small independent studio that just released a VR game called Orion 13.
When you play a regular PC game, you know, you're driving them around and you're watching them. And even in first person, it's still on your PC screen and you look around and there's your roommate eating crackers, you know. When you put on that headset, you are completely immersed in a world. And you look around and what's behind you and you can be anywhere I could possibly imagine I could put you in there.
So, but why is that important to you? Like, is it something you were just sort of seeking a different sensation?
It's a quantum leap. It's a quantum difference.
My first experience with virtual reality will happen here in Klebnik's stylish modern living room. They're going to let me play the new game, and I have no idea what to expect. The video games I grew up with sounded like this. We've come a long way since Baseball Stars on Nintendo, but really VR has been around for a long time. Back in the 1980s, it was used for flight simulations and military training. VR as a modern gaming system, though, accessible to people like you and me, is much newer, and it really hasn't caught on yet. Last year, fewer than 6 million VR headsets were shipped, according to Nielsen data. Compare that to the tens of millions of traditional gaming consoles sold each year.
2020 is once again being declared to be VR's make or break year. Now, people have been saying that since roughly 2014.
Robert Morgan heads up a small VR studio in London. And 2014, that was the year that Facebook got into the game. The social media company made a $3 billion bet on a company that makes VR headsets called Oculus.
As a player, Oculus has definitely become kind of the Kleenex of virtual reality in many ways and have been since the start.
Facebook has been pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into developing content so people will actually buy the headsets. Now you can play a popular board game, Settlers of Catan, in VR, or fight alongside Spider-Man. But that's not good enough for Scott Matalon.
Especially in the beginning, my reaction was, where's the beef? Where's the real meat? Where's the games, you know? And so I set out to start making the kind of games that I like to play. Big open world games where I can move around and I can solve a problem to get around these orcs. I can fight them. I can sneak around them. I can pull them one at a time. I have options because I'm in control of my character and my environment. And I wanted to have that same experience in VR. And I wasn't getting it.
Before I can play his game, I need to start with baby steps. Matalon and his colleague, Seth Manti, help me put on the gear. First, I have to slip my hands into the controllers. They look like the handles of a ski pole.
And these are actually used for tracking. We have these sensors here, and they track where...
Then, the headset, which looks like a clunky pair of black goggles.
And it's going to go on. the crown of your head first. We can adjust this to be a little bit tighter and more comfortable.
Is this the Oculus
headset? This is the Oculus Rift headset.
Okay.
It's the original one.
Wow. Okay, here we go.
So, tell us if this is clearer or is this clearer?
Suddenly I'm at the eye doctor. Just try again. With the headset on, the living room I've been sitting in suddenly disappears. A new digital world is all around me. Hello? Hello? I am now on some foreign planet with an alien waving to me and saying hello. Then the scene changes. Now I'm hundreds of feet above what looks like the city of Gotham.
Whoa!
That's what I was talking
about. My. Ho, ho, ho. I'm at the edge of a very tall building. Oh my gosh, there's traffic buzzing down below. Oh my god, there's a blimp up to my... Oh, who did I just hit? I'm sorry. I'm so immersed in this world, waving my arms around frantically, that I'm bumping into things in the real world. But they say I'm ready for the main act. Madelon switches on Orion 13.
Time to die.
And now I'm transported to a robotic neon city. Above me, tall buildings. Behind me, robots walking around. Look down, and there's my body. Or the body of the robot that I'm playing, Orion 13.
Okay, and you can look all the way down. If you lean forward and look down, you can see you've got legs.
Oh my gosh. That's
you've got a whole body.
Yes, I do.
Yes, you are a female combat robot who has become self-aware and has these memory implants. And she's become self-aware and she wants to go home. She believes these memories are hers.
Orion 13 has crossed the threshold. Threshold, sir. She's become self-aware and now she wants to go home.
To get home and to win the game, I have to slash my way through a crowd of those evil robots trying to stop me.
If you look, you've got the sword in your hand, in your right hand.
Oh, wow.
And if you swing it, you swing it around, right? The faster and longer your arm arc is, the more damage and the harder you hit.
Again, I'm frantically swinging my arms, and the evil robots are going down. Up ahead, there's an elevator bay, and when I go inside, it carries me to the top of a very tall building.
Look down at the edge there, and now you can drop down there.
Well, let's
do
it.
You can kind of just jump.
Okay, like I'm jumping off a cliff.
Yeah.
You know, just walk.
Yep, boom. All right. And there's some...
So you just fell 50 feet in VR.
I'm sweating. Oof, wow.
All right, you take that headset off.
Yeah, all right.
I want you to know that you did as
well.
Whoa,
real life. Sorry, I'm really sweating.
Grab a water for us. Yeah, you did really, really
well. I did okay?
You did great.
Like, I really am
really
soaking wet.
Right. And that was easy.
I have to say that taking off the mask and seeing Klebnik's modern living room again was the most jarring part of this experience. British VR designer Robert Morgan says that disconnect is part of the reason VR has been slow to catch on.
There's a friction to stepping into virtual reality, which really, I think, we underestimated in many ways how hard that would be to overcome, because the fact that they go into their space helmet and they can't see their dog or their beer or their family, it's a major factor that reduces the appeal of these types of experiences beyond, you know, Christmas Day or Black Friday when you're first trying these things out.
I ask Madelon and Klebnik what they think about that. Klebnik says it's an issue.
What we've already seen as companies are experimenting with this is, like, Google came out with Daydream, right, where they basically had a small headset where you could take your phone and put it in and be in a VR experience. They cratered it. Nobody wanted to take their mobile device and all of a sudden be disconnected from the world around them. You are immersed in this.
Well, is that a problem for you in the industry, do you think?
I kind of have to disagree with Mike at a different level. People want more interaction with their content. Movies have gotten longer. They've now got the Vader Immortal series has been coming out on VR, and it just puts you in Star Wars. If you're a Star Wars fan, that is what you want. You want to be there. If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, and I play Lord of the Rings online on PC, the day it comes out on VR, I'm going to buy it because I want to stand on the wall at Helm's Deep and look out over a 10,000 orcs in front of me.
Yeah.
Like, I want more interaction with my content.
One of the things I wasn't expecting to want to ask you about before I got here, but then after I experienced it, I do. What's your take on the role of violence? Because you are so much more immersed in the experience, is it different if it's virtual reality? Is it more intense, and could that be a problem?
We see violence in TV, we see violence in movies, we see violence in games. There's always some segment of the population that is going to be susceptible to be influenced by it, but I think most of us view it as it's an entertainment product. I'm not running around shooting people up because I watched a movie.
But at the same time, there are a number of VR games that have pushed that gore to a limit that, for me, I would say crosses a line of just being gratuitous.
Yeah.
Heads exploding, blood splattering all over the place.
It's the same thing for movies.
Like, you watch Saw. It's the same
thing. Except for the person who's playing is physically making the motion of a stabbing or a slashing. You know, you're doing something.
It's spectator sport versus participant sport.
The experience that I had, where I still can physically feel the game in my body, even after some minutes after having played it. Is that a drawback? Because for me, I feel a little uncomfortable physically. I mean, is that something that you have to get over?
So I think it's an individual thing. Some people are much more tolerant than others are to it. Clearly, as you saw, it does change where you are in the room and space and time. And it is a little bit uncomfortable after you do it. But what we've seen is that people really are more comfortable over time with it.
The motion sickness I felt actually lingered for several hours. Another hurdle to clear is the price. A typical VR system could set you back more than $1,000. But Matalon is confident that VR is on the cusp of going mainstream, if it hasn't already.
The VR industry is going to succeed because this is like nothing else. There is nothing else like this, and this is going to become a part of our lives.
And maybe it will. Last holiday season, Oculus and another manufacturer called Valve sold out of headsets. And if 2020 is finally the year VR takes off, we will be one step further away from every video game you've ever played before. President Trump opened a visit to India with a huge rally today in Ahmedabad. That's the largest city in Prime Minister Narendra Modi's home state of Gujarat. More than 100,000 people packed into the world's largest cricket stadium to see him. NPR's Lauren Freyer joins us now from Ahmedabad. And Lauren, from our vantage point here, this looked like quite the spectacle. What did you see?
Right. So you mentioned 100,000 people, more than 100,000 people cheering. The crowd was carefully vetted, though. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and President Trump have both faced protesters in their respective countries. There were no dissenters at this rally. The crowd was absolutely cheering both leaders. They're both right-wing populists who have played to nationalism and majoritarianism in their own countries. And you could hear hints of Trump's America First slogan when he addressed the crowd here. He suggested that Prime Minister Modi shares some of his outlook.
Both of us understand that when leaders put the interests of their own citizens first, we can forge strong and fair partnerships to build a safer and more prosperous world.
So Trump talked about working with India to fight Islamist terrorism. He also talked about growing commerce with India. And the U.S. increasingly looks to India as a buffer to China's rising power in the Indo-Pacific. So India is becoming more important for the U.S.
You mentioned that both men have this populist and nationalist streak, but I want to ask you more about that because Modi has a pretty deep history where this event was today. He was the chief minister in Gujarat for more than a decade. Business was great. The economy was great while he was in charge there. But he was also blamed for a surge in anti-Muslim violence. Still an issue in his administration years later across India, really. Do you expect President Trump to bring that up at all during this trip?
He made some comments today saying the U.S. appreciates the diversity of India. That could be a veiled reference to protect the diversity of India. Modi is a Hindu nationalist. He believes that India should be a Hindu nation with special rights for its Hindu majority. You spoke about Modi being the chief minister in Gujarat during a bloody period of history. That was the 2002 Gujarat riots, maybe the bloodiest chapter of recent Hindu-Muslim relations in India. What happened was in 2002, a train carrying Hindu pilgrims was set on fire in Gujarat in an area with a large Muslim population. 59 Hindus were killed, and then anti-Muslim riots erupted, and more than 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed. And he was accused of, at the very least, failing to halt the violence, but possibly even inciting it. He toured the state afterward, giving fiery speeches using derogatory language about Muslims. Modi always denies any wrongdoing. But allegations persisted, and in fact, the U.S. refused to grant him a visa for years.
From a policy perspective, what's next on this trip? Because it does not look like there will be any progress made on a trade deal that had been on the table.
Right. So Trump has played down the idea of a trade deal coming through in time for his visit. The two countries have slapped tariffs on one another's imports over the past 2 years. Trump has said India treats the U.S. unfairly when it comes to trade. But, you know, he says he likes Modi, and maybe the power of that friendship could lead to some breakthroughs.
That's NPR's Lauren Freyer in India. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Dow dropped nearly 1,000 at the open today, and that was before the World Health Organization announced that while we are not yet seeing a pandemic, the world is not ready to deal with a global outbreak of COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. There are now confirmed cases in Afghanistan, Bahrain, Iraq, and Kuwait. And while the majority of COVID-19 cases are still in China, there are at least 800 people with the virus in South Korea. At least 12 people have died from it in Iran, schools and cultural centers across 14 provinces shut down in an attempt to control the outbreak. In Italy, at least 219 people have tested positive for the virus, leading the government to ask people who may have been exposed to quarantine themselves at home. Well, that's a tactic other cities around the world are also taking to contain the virus's spread. For instance, here in the U.S., in King County, Washington, which includes Seattle, 400 people who've recently traveled back from China are monitoring themselves. Others who are at the highest risks for COVID-19 are in home quarantine. And it's public health workers who are helping them. Dr. Megan Kay is a medical epidemiologist. She's leading containment efforts for Seattle and King County, Washington. Dr. Megan, you've had people going in and out of quarantine as they're cleared, but about 16 at one time, people determined to be at high risk. And so you're helping them with everything they need. What does that include?
So that includes making sure they have enough food, and we provide them food for a few days at a time. We have them fill out a grocery list so that we can meet their dietary needs and provide food that they're comfortable eating. We also provide meal kits, which include paper plates, bowls, cups, silverware, and then hygiene kits for shampoo, conditioner, soap, lotion, things like that that they may not be able to get out and get if we're asking them to stay home. We also make sure that they have thermometers and masks so they can measure their temperature daily, and masks in case they need to seek health care so that they don't expose a waiting room full of people. We also want to make sure that they have good Wi-Fi, great internet access while they are staying home and away from other people so that they can stay connected with family and friends and even work if they're feeling well.
Well, this is wild. You're kind of like Peapod, you know, a shopping service for people. But you're doing this. I mean, just so I've got this right, this is a cost to your agency, to the state.
Exactly. So we're doing the best we can with limited resources. This was really taxing our disease investigation group here. And so we identified locally within our health department an isolation and quarantine coordinator that could take on some of this burden from our disease investigation team and help coordinate delivery of groceries and delivery of other things that people might need while they're staying isolated. They're also helping to coordinate access to other services like insurance if people don't have insurance access, or things like helping with documentation that might be needed for employers or for FMLA, things like that.
Oh, FMLA?
Yes, the family medical leave so that they can get support while they're staying out of work.
I mean, this is just amazing, everything that your workers are doing. I mean, you mentioned Wi-Fi and shampoo, but it also might mean housing. It might mean being able to continue their faith. Maybe they need a counselor because this is frightening. I mean, do I understand you also might get someone help if they're getting a little panicky?
Absolutely. We do provide them access and refer them to counseling services if that's needed. Other things, like you said, if they aren't local King County residents that are here on business or travel and for some reason or another need to be isolated or quarantined, then we have looked into providing them a place to stay for the night at a local motel that we've worked with. Yeah. And so it does go beyond with just the basics of food to trying to make sure that they have other needs met, behavioral health needs as well.
And how do your workers stay safe? We know that, you know, people on ships were told to stay 6 feet away from each other, which, by the way, mm-hmm. might have worked for people in their cabins, but it didn't work for the workers on the ship who are sleeping dormitory style. But how are your workers making sure they're safe?
Our workers don't have close contact with the people that are being isolated. So they deliver the groceries and supplies at the door, and then the person who's being isolated will collect those after our public health staff have left. Sometimes if they need to actually be seen in a hospital setting, like if they need a chest x-ray or something like that, then we have worked with local ambulance companies to provide that transport safely because we don't want them using public transportation.
Of course.
The other option is that we have a home assessment team that we have worked with in collaboration with our local hospital. And so that team can actually go out to the home or other isolation location and do an evaluation of patients if they need it.
Look, your assistance, I'm sure, is such a benefit and such a comfort to these people. But it occurs, it also means that you're on the front lines of this and your workers will know if someone breaks the quarantine, you know, if they leave their house. I'm wondering if that's a part of it. But also, we're hearing from our NPR colleague Jason Bobian in Hong Kong that, you know, you've had to deal with 16... In Hong Kong, it's thousands, and officials there, you know, can't go to door to door. So some people who are at higher risk are being fit with wrist monitors, kind of like an ankle bracelet, so they can be tracked. So is part of your work keeping an eye on people as well? Are you considering what happens if you actually do have to put people on some sort of a tracking device to make sure they don't leave?
Right now, we've had tremendous support and cooperation from the people who are being asked to separate themselves. And so they are being asked to do this voluntarily, and everyone that we've worked with has complied. So that hasn't been a big problem for us. But we do anticipate that there will eventually be sustained person-to-person transmission. And so right now, this is just a strategy to buy us some time while we prepare for more widespread transmission here.
Wow. Just so people, if people are wondering, what is it that you will, you know, go purchase for these people? You have a shopping list there?
Yeah, when we are asking somebody to separate themselves, we ask them to fill out a grocery list. And so an example from one person was 2 to 3 green vegetables of any kind, a bottle of juice, some skim milk, fruit, plain spaghetti, fresh tomatoes, plain oats, and some beef. So that's an example. We ask them to provide us with that because everyone has their own dietary restrictions and dietary needs, and we want them to have the food that they need to be comfortable.
Your office sent us another list. It included Tostitos avocado salsa.
Yes, you know, I saw that.
Tough to be there without snacks. But, you know, this is just a great service. People need food. But, what, you know, why else do you do this?
There are a couple of reasons why we do it. We are asking people to isolate or quarantine themselves, and in doing that, they're giving up some of their freedom for the greater good, to protect the health of others in the community. And so it's really the right thing to do to support them. But also, of course, it helps ensure that they're able to be compliant with our directions.
You mentioned such an important thing. They are voluntarily sacrificing their liberty for the greater good.
Exactly.
I'm sure cities and counties are listening closely to you. What can they learn from you? What's been the cost so far?
It's been really expensive and resource intensive for our team. We started this the day that the first case in the United States was identified here in Washington in our neighboring county, and that was January 21st. And we've been going really nonstop since that. A lot of these issues pop up in the evening after hours, and we have a team available 24/7. We are spending over $200,000 every week, and we've redirected staff from other departments. We have over 100 people working in our department to contain COVID-19 here.
And so looking to the federal government maybe for more funds?
Yes, we are asking for more support and resources at the local level. It is not sustainable to do this kind of work at this pace and this volume with the resources that we have.
Yeah.
We absolutely need more support.
Well, Dr. Megan Kay, we're going to let you go back to your good work. She's in charge of COVID-19 containment efforts in King County, Washington. That includes Seattle. Really quite something. Dr. Kay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, as Dr. Kay mentioned, the first reported patient with COVID-19 in the U.S. was in Washington State. Health officials now say that person has fully recovered and is free from home isolation. And by the way, Americans who were evacuated from that Diamond Princess cruise ship in Japan are in quarantine in several locations in the U.S., including in Texas, Nebraska, and California. So what's happening in Seattle is perhaps a cautionary tale for health officials across the country.
On Native American reservations, asthma rates are high and the cases are often severe. Researchers are trying to understand the environmental factors influencing asthma among children on the Navajo Nation, and they're trying to help educate families. Eilish O'Neill traveled to the Navajo Reservation in northern Arizona and has this report.
The Navajo Reservation is a vast desert landscape, more than 27,000 square miles. That's about the size of West Virginia. It's dry, dusty, and windy, and bitterly cold in the winter. Chelsea Holtzoy lives on this reservation with the five of her children who are still at home. Her son Ethan is 10. He likes playing football with his friends, and his favorite subject at school is math. When he was younger, Ethan was often really sick. Once, when he was 3 years old, he got a terrible fever.
I start getting scared. Ice water we got. We put a rag in it, we wrung it out, we're just wiping his body down. Pretty soon the water was warm from just wiping him down.
When the ice water didn't help, Holtzwey gave her son ibuprofen, but she says his temperature just kept going up.
It's really a scary experience, especially when they're that small. It just hurt just looking at him.
Holtzwey rushed him to the nearest clinic. There, the doctors told her Ethan didn't just have a fever. He was having an asthma attack, and his oxygen levels were alarmingly low. They wanted to send him to an intensive care unit in Phoenix, a five-hour drive away. So Holtzoy and Ethan boarded a medevac plane, and they went.
I just kept looking at him, and I was scared. And I just kept praying and praying and praying when we're in the plane. No parent should ever experience that.
Ethan had to spend about a week in the ICU before he was well enough to leave. The National Institutes of Health reports that approximately 13% of American Indian children have asthma, compared with nearly 9% of children in the general population. The Navajo Nation has the largest population of all Native American nations, and the reservation spans across three states.
The environmental exposures here are impossible to control.
Diana Hu is a pediatrician who's worked on the Navajo Reservation for 35 years.
We have, you know, Russian thistles or, you know, tumbleweeds everywhere. We have elms everywhere. We have cottonwoods everywhere.
Those are all plants that can set off kids' allergies, which can trigger an asthma attack. There's some evidence that climate change is increasing the amount of pollen in the air, which some researchers say is contributing to the rise of asthma. Coal mines and long rides on diesel school buses also contribute to asthma on the Navajo Reservation. And there's something else.
We always had a wood stove. That's one thing I didn't really want to use as a heating source, but that's all we could afford.
That's Chelsea Holtzoy again. Like 60% of families here, she heats her house with a wood stove.
Oh, same as yours.
It's black, with a little door for putting wood in and a wide stovepipe coming out of the back. It has no filter to keep smoke and ash out of the cabin, the way more expensive wood stoves do. Holtzoy says she can't afford anything else, though she wishes she could. When it's smoky, it triggers Ethan's asthma.
He gets really mucusy. It's like boogers. And like you can hear it. You can hear those boogers, and he'll try to spit it out. And so it sounds congested.
To try to keep him healthy, Holtzoy makes sure the stovepipe is clean so smoke won't blow back into the cabin. And she always has a pot of water on the stove so there's steam in the air.
The doctors told us, make sure you always have a pot of water to keep the air kind of humid for them, not dry.
In the past, when federal agencies like the CDC tried to help lower asthma rates on the reservation, the efforts were met with resistance because of mistrust of the government. That's why, on some reservations, researchers and healthcare providers are trying new, community-based approaches.
We're basically taking proven interventions that we've done in non-Native communities and adapting them, you know, for these Native communities.
That's Lynn Gerald. She's a professor at the University of Arizona who's developing a community asthma education program on the Navajo Nation. Gerald and her team are working with health representatives from the Navajo Nation to reach out to families to improve their care of children with asthma. She says families and schools can make minor changes that can help prevent asthma attacks. For example, to help kids avoid breathing in diesel exhaust from school buses.
One of the things that can be done is keeping the windows up on the bus so that the diesel that's outside doesn't get in. If the pollen levels are very high, then a child with asthma might need to stay indoors that day rather than going outside for PE or outside to play.
Gerald says educating the community has been challenging. For one thing, older generations on the reservation aren't always familiar with the condition. There isn't even a word in Navajo for asthma, so it's hard to explain to grandparents, who are often the caretakers, that it's a chronic condition that needs regular medication.
Cover your mouth.
Back at the Holtzoy home, Ethan and one of his brothers sit on a couch next to their mom, eating chips. Ethan's now 10, and he's doing better. Holtzoy says the doctors put him on a new medication, and he hasn't been to the emergency room since.
He's been doing pretty good in PE and stuff. And
I usually
tell them, like, if you're going to go running, make sure he takes a puff before he does his workouts. I just want him to get better.
For Here and Now, I'm Elise O'Neill.
And that story was funded in part by the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.